So, welcome to another WASAC here at the Buddhist Society of Victoria. We've been here many, many years, and it's nice to see everything grow. I know that Buddhism is growing in Australia, so am I. And so is the Sangha as well. It's nice to see that happening, because we do take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. And of course, that Sangha is not one particular monk, or one particular tradition. I often say this to people, that you don't take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and Ajahn this, or Sayod, or that, or Rinpoche, something else. It's always in the Sangha, the great tradition. And of course, that was the Buddha's wish. It was his mission, very clearly stated, to establish thriving groups of monks, nuns, fully ordained nuns, laymen and laywomen. And it was an inspiration that such a long time ago somebody is asking you for this message. Must be the message from the heavenly realms, or it's from the lower realms, it's more likely from the neighbors or the police. Which one is this? Okay. Parking infringement. Oh my goodness. So anyway, I shouldn't say those little stories to get into trouble. I know there was one fellow, sometimes the innovation, the people who innovate, they do it the wrong ways, because there was a fellow which I heard about over in London, because he could never find a parking space, you know, when he went to work. So he went on the internet, and straight away he could actually order his own wheel clamp. So he bought one on the internet, a wheel clamp, and so he would park anywhere in London, and in the morning he'd open up his boot and put the wheel clamp on his car, his own wheel clamp, and so when the parking inspector came by, straight away he saw that it was already clamped. So, just let him stay there, and then in the evening he'd just take his key, take the clamp off, put it in the boot and drive home. That way he could drive anywhere he wanted. And park anywhere he wanted. Sometimes people have these wonderful ideas, but it's a shame they don't use these ideas, for more virtuous purposes. But the innovation is great, and that sort of innovation, the insight, the ways of looking at things in a deeper, more interesting way, is really important in the Dhamma. In Buddhism. So that's one of the reasons why we come here. We come here because we're seeing things in a different way, celebrating a time when, even for the Buddha, the story of the Buddha, trying so hard, to become enlightened, trying so hard to solve the problems of the world, and his own problems as well. And just deciding afterwards, those 6 years of going in another direction, not doing the same old thing, but finding another way of doing things. And that idea of insight, that idea of doing things a little bit differently, that is almost like the heart of the Buddha's teachings. And it's the reason why, though, we can take these teachings, but not just the form of the teachings, but sometimes where they come from, to understand how this whole thing works and how we can move things forward in this world. So, here we go. This is a nice example. I live a very interesting life, surprising as a Buddhist monk. I always thought I'd just spend the time in the cave or just, in a monastery. But you go all over the place teaching. And it was a couple of years ago that I was invited to give a talk. It was in Korea, in Daejeon, and that was for the World Computer Conference. I forget which particular one, 6th or 7th, one of the World Computer Congress. And I was invited there to give the keynote address, not just an ordinary presentation. But when the president and the chairman, they all give their sort of welcomes, then the first person to give the talk, that was me, in the whole plenary session with all of these people who were the European Union head of cybersecurity, and all these CEOs from LG and from Samsung and all these other people there from all the big, and people ask me, what are you doing there, Ajahn Brahm? You're a monk, what do you know about computers? And if anyone in Awata knows this, that whenever anything goes wrong, I've got all my tech support, which is the other monks who are much younger than me, to fix things up. They're my tech support. But what was I doing there? And the reason is because when you can look at things a slightly different way, do things a slightly different than most people do, it's amazing just how much innovation and breakthroughs you can actually get. So when people were wondering what the heck I was doing there, and I said about innovation, and what I did, I had one of those plastic water bottles, and now I've got this cup of water here, and I held it up. This is one of my water similes, and it says, "Now, what actually is this?" And I asked the audience, "Now, what is this? Please describe it to me." As I asked you, "Now, what is this? Is that all it is? What else is it? Clay, vessel, yeah. Please keep on, give me some more information. What is this? What can you see? Yeah, describe it. Keep on going.
It's a mud water.
Yeah, keep on going. Now, first of all, you can see that straight away, we're trying to get the right answer. And there is no right answer. If you think you've got the right answer, and you know, I say, "Yes, you've got it, Mr. President. Congratulations." No, that's not the point. We always think we have the right answer, which means we stop looking further. So when you keep on looking further, the more you look, the more you can see. And there comes a time when you're looking at something like a cup of whatever it is, you come to a time when you've exhausted all your ideas. You know, you say a cup, it's more than a cup. You say it's ceramic, it's more than that. You say it's white, it's cylindrical, it's more than that. And once you go past your received knowledge, your old ideas, then you can actually start to see things new, more. Like, for example, this was one of Ajahn Chah's. He could see things and he went deeper into what this actually is. Because he would often say that, "Ajahn Brahm, can you see the crack in this cup? Can you see the crack in the cup? You look a bit further, can't see the crack in it. It's got a crack in it." You're giving the monk a cracked cup. But it has got a crack in it, but it's too small for most people to see. It's microscopic. It's called the crack of impermanence, of anicca, of breakability, unsustainability. The fact that no matter how much you look after this ceramic cup, that one day someone is going to drop it. They're going to kick it. It's going to fall off the edge of wherever it's kept. And it's going to break. It's going to shatter. It's the crack of impermanence. Now, what does that mean? It means that because you can see that crack in this cup, you realize that you have to look after it. If this was some plastic, some unbreakable material, something which you think would last forever, then you would not need to care for it. You could put it anywhere, throw it around, drop it, because it was permanent, unbreakable. Because it's breakable, that's why you must care. And that was a lot of time Ajahn Chah's little simile. Every one of you which I see here, I've been coming to the BSV for years, you're all cracked. Nuns included, you're all cracked. Me too. And what that crack means is that, you know, you're impermanent. One day you're going to fall apart, one day you're going to die, one day this is going to happen, that's going to happen. But because you're all cracked because this building is cracked, because the Buddha Society of Victoria is cracked. That's why we've got to look after it. That's why we've got to care for it. This is the sort of similes you get when you take something as simple as a cup and then you explore it to see deeper meanings to it. So that's one of the reasons why that when we have the Buddha just trying to get enlightened, trying all the old ways, and having to try and do something different, to actually to stop, to pause, and just to allow the Dhamma, the truth, to open up to you. Because you know, these days, people have all sorts of arguments about what is the right way to practice. Is it the Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana? Well, whenever we try to actually to combine the traditions, we always just make a new tradition. It's really weird, isn't it? Instead of just trying to say who is the best tradition, who is, that there's something so terribly wrong with that. The fact that we can't sort of work together, even as Buddhists, or even as other human beings, not even if you're Buddhists. Why can't we all sort of learn just how to live in some peace and harmony together? And of course, one of those reasons is because I'm right and you're wrong. Thank you, Cora. You know what happens, that it's all that idea, what do you mean that somebody's right and somebody's wrong? Why can't you admit that you're wrong? Life is much easier when you say, yes, I'm wrong. Because if I could admit that and you could accept that all the time, and if I say, oh yeah, all my understanding about Buddhism is wrong, all my ordination of nuns was wrong, all this was wrong, and then I'd be free. I'd have a nice, easy life. No? But anyway, this is one of the reasons why do people try and protect, you know, their truth, what they think is the truth. They say, this is what a cup is. This is what the Dhamma is. When they realize that Dhamma, that truth, is just causing more arguments. So can we have like a Dhamma, an understanding, a deeper understanding of the truth, which doesn't cause arguments, which can unite people rather than dividing people? And look, this is, sometimes I like just taking things a little bit further, but it actually helps. You know, in our modern, which is the best form of Buddhism? What do you mean best form? There's only one form of Buddhism, and that's whatever leads to peace, to tranquility, to freedom, and you can actually feel it. So sometimes, that's one of the reasons why, if you can have a little bit of insight, and this here, this is nothing which is really specifically religious. When I told the World Computer Congress in Daejeon, sort of, you know, what actually is this? That wasn't really dogmatic, but it was showing just how we can actually go deeper and find some understanding, find some truth. In other words, put aside everything which you've ever heard before. Put aside those ideas and see if you can see beyond thinking. Because you know, all the thinking which I've ever had was always just what I'd been taught, what I'd been conditioned with. And for me, that was something which was blocking the truth. And of course, you started learning this, you know, when you were at university. That truth would always be something which was confronting. It was not reaffirming what you've heard before, what you knew before, but taking it even deeper to just another level of understanding. And of course, you know, that was with something like the science, the theoretical physics, which you did. But you know, even there was a lot of dogmatism, a lot of protecting who was right and who was wrong. And that's one of the reasons why there's so many people, which when I was at university, they thought, you're stupid, you're wrong, that can't be true. And now they've got Nobel Prizes for what they suggested. And a lot of times the truth should always be considered to be work in action. Never think that you have found the final answer, because if you do, you find that you get into big arguments with people. So instead, there was what Ajahn Chah used to often teach. Whenever there was an argument, you know, he would say to those two people, "You're right, but you're not correct, and you are correct, but you're not right." So what was actually meaning there, that the very fact that you were arguing meant that there's something you were missing out that you didn't see. You didn't see sort of the qualities. And this brings me on to one of those old stories about sort of harmony and why on earth it is that people argue with one another. And that was the story of years ago when there was the story of the event in Guantanamo Bay, when there was these US Marines. They were accused, we don't know if it was true or not, but they were accused of taking a copy of the Islamic holy book, the Quran, and just flushing it down the toilet. And actually, if you really think about that, did you hear about that accusation?
Yeah.
Now, have you ever seen a book? How can you flush it down a toilet? You know, straight away, if you actually stop sort of getting arguing about it and just think about the logistics, it's pretty impossible. But nevertheless, that was, even if you tried tearing it up, Cora, you'd be tearing it up for a long time and you'd bung up the toilet. So you know what it's like in a BSV on WASAC day, and that's just ordinary toilet paper, let alone trying to put a book down the loo. So anyway, I think it was pretty impossible. Nevertheless, that wasn't the point, because there were some riots. And that was when a journalist from the Australian newspaper, he called me up in Perth, because he was looking for a Buddhist leader to respond, to what was happening. And so he said to me over the phone, very quickly, I've been contacting as many religious leaders in Australia as I possibly can. I've already checked out the Catholics and the Anglicans and the Hindus and the Jewish community. But now I want to contact you, Ajahn Brahm. You're a leader of the Buddhist community. So can you please tell me an answer straight away what I've asked everybody else from the community? What would you do, Ajahn Brahm, if somebody took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down your toilet? That was the question. And you sort of couldn't sort of wait to give an answer. You had to sort of give it straight away, because that's what the journalist wanted, quick response. But I sort of straight away, I said, if somebody flushed a Buddhist holy book down my toilet, straight away I'd call the plumber. Because I have to use those toilets. And that's one of the nice things about real Buddhism. It's very practical, very down to earth. So anyway, but then afterwards, I always remember him telling me, "That's the first sensible answer I've got all day. Thank you so much." Which was a great accolade to Buddhism. It's sensible, it's down to earth, people can understand it. Instead of like sometimes that some of the talks or some of the concepts are so profound that no one understands it. Because when I was a layperson, that would be what happened. I'd go to these talks, and after the talk, we'd discuss. I was a layperson, said, "Oh, that was a very deep, yeah, it was very profound. Yeah, it must have been so deep because I didn't understand a word of it." And that's one of the nice things about real Dhamma, is something you can really, really understand straight away. So, okay, please get up and get some nice seats over there out of compassion. Very good. There we go. So anyway, because of that, I said, well, a deeper answer is this. Because it was just a few years after the Bamiyan Buddha statues were destroyed. And I was very proud of the Buddha's response, because we didn't sort of take revenge and destroy something else. in the same time, in those weeks they took to destroy the Bamiyan Buddha statues. Many places in this world, they made thousands of other Buddha statues. So it's after that week, we came out on a profit. We ended up with more Buddha statues afterwards. But I told him, look, you can destroy as many Buddha statues as you want. You can flush all the Buddhist scriptures down the toilet. You can burn them. That's just what I told this journalist. You can burn down the monasteries, kill all the monks and nuns. But I will never, ever allow you to destroy Buddhism. To destroy the peace, the forgiveness, the compassion, the non-violence, which is what's inside those books. It's what that Buddha statue conveys. It's a meaning why we have monks and nuns. It's a meaning why, we have temples. So I made the very important distinction between the container and the contents. The BSV is a container. This building is not the BSV. It's the people and their behavior when they come in here. NBM will never be the monastery. It's the monks and the nuns and how peaceful and harmonious they are. That is the monastery. It's not the suttas. It's what they teach. What's inside those suttas? That is the important thing. But today often we confuse the container with the contents. And we try and preserve the container at all costs, even if it means destroying the contents and ignoring those contents. So this is one of the reasons why, that even all these ideas and thoughts, they're containers. What are those thoughts? What are those, the Dhamma? What are those teachings actually pointing to? You put up a cup. It's not just a cup. What's it pointing to? What's the deeper meaning of it? So this is actually where we find that if we start having arguments and violence, we haven't understood the meaning at all. Because the whole purpose of this is one of the teachings of the Buddha, which really impressed me. Very short. He gave this first of all to his Baba Upali, who became the Vinaya master, and then he also repeated it to the first bhikkhuni, Mahaprajapati. And he said, just whatever teachings you know from experience, lead to renunciation, to letting go, to peace, for fading away, for nibbana, you will know those as the real teachings of the Buddha. It's not by what it said or who said it, it's actually where it leads. Does it lead to peace, to harmony, to this letting go of the problems of life? To the disappearing of the arguments and divisions which people make between one another. If it's leading to that, he said, yes, that has got the stamp, this is good Buddhist teachings. So it's because of that we look in a different way. And to be able to look in that different way, that's one of the reasons why the Buddha was going to many, many teachers before he sat under the Bodhi tree. And even when he sat under the Bodhi tree, have you ever seen a Bodhi tree? Like a big one? Have you ever tried to sit underneath it? Because it's just so many roots, and it's so knobbly. You'd have a sore bottom in a few seconds if you were trying to sit under a Bodhi tree. So straight away, when they said to sit at the foot of a tree, sometimes like being sort of like a Western monk, you say, well, how can you sit under the root of a tree? Especially a Bodhi tree, one of the great fig trees. The nearest memory we have here is the old Moreton Bay figs. They've got roots all over the place. So to find a nice little place where you can sit, of course, the Buddha needed to get some grass to sit on. And that's what it was actually saying. And this is an important part. Instead of trying to be ascetic and trying to sort of force the body, and trying to make, oh yeah, it's uncomfortable, but, so often I've seen this in monastic life, people actually forcing their body too much. We've got all these stories of one monk, he decided to meditate all night, Waisak. not move, enlightenment or bust. You know what happened? Bust, yeah. We had to take him the following day for a knee reconstruction. He had double knee reconstruction. Actually dumb. I admire his fortitude and his endurance, but you know, not his wisdom. Fortunately, he learned from that. And there was this other monk. You know, when the first monks who ever went to England, it was not sort of Ajahn Sumedho, there was other monks before then. And this one monk, you know, he's really a tough monk. And he was reading in the suttas that even the Buddha, when it was really cold, he would just go out and he would just use his three robes, nothing else. And that's all. Even when it was, they could say actually in the time of the snow. But you know, it's really hard to understand. We still don't understand exactly what that was, because it doesn't snow in the Ganges valleys, but it did actually seem to say they may have had a snow period and cold. But anyway, he said that just the three robes were enough for him. And he said that for the simplicity of the monks. So this monk, he was staying in Hampstead in the winter time, and he said, well, if the Buddha can do this, I should do this. So he went out on Hampstead Heath, just with the three robes, meditated there all night, in the snow. You know what happened? No, it's pneumonia. Had to be in hospital for many weeks. And you tell those stories because sometimes that we get in the thoughts, we get in sort of, you know, trying to, you know, be the best, the ego, my tradition's best, I'm going to do it, this is what we're going to do. And I must admit, I put my hand up there, because one of the first Waisaks which I ever went to as a lay person, was still in Cambridge, it was this Sri Lankan monk, Dr. Sadatissa, if anyone remembers him. But, you know, he came up and took the Waisak ceremony in Cambridge for us. I just, you know, a young Buddhist, really wet behind the ears and everywhere else, and really green, and not really knowing, but very inspired. And you know, out of my conceit, you know what I said? Well, you know, just if the Buddha can do it, you know, well, why not me as well? And I thought, well, you know, there's, you know, I've got a good degree, and the Buddha didn't have that degree in training, and so maybe I can survive this. And so afterwards, after the ceremonies were finished, I went back to my room. And I put out my cushion. And I, before I sat down, I bowed to this little statue of the Buddha I had in my room. And I made this resolution. And I said, I really was of much sincerity, I am not going to move from my meditation cushion. I was about 18, 19 at the time. I'm not going to move until I'm fully enlightened, or that my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust. And I really meant it. I was going to do this. Because, you know, you're young, you're busy, you've got many things to do in your life. I want to get enlightenment out of the way so I can go and do other things. The first one on my list to go. So I did that very, very, oh, there's a phone call there, somebody's complaining. I didn't tell you that the housekeeping, please turn off your mobile phones, cell phones. Yeah, because we have this tradition, that this great understanding that if your mobile phone goes off during a meditation or during a talk, it makes bad karma for your mobile phone. And in the next lifetime, your phone will get reincarnated as a police speed camera. The lowest form of life for technology, in my opinion. So please turn off your mobile phone. And that's also for cars. If your car is badly parked, we would say that gets a bad karma and its next incarnation will be reincarnated as a bicycle. Actually, bicycle is quite a high incarnation, isn't it? Gives people exercise. No pollution. So, be reincarnated as a skateboard. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, let's get back to the talk about sort of that trying too hard, forcing it. It was just being still a prisoner of my own ideas and conceptions, and I just what happened? 30 minutes 30 minutes and I was already just really hurting. 35 minutes and I was getting really, really desperate and I wasn't enlightened yet. I gave it another 5 minutes to get enlightened. I had 40 minutes and I was in such agony, I had to open my eyes and I checked my body and it was so disappointing. I wasn't enlightened and my bones hadn't turned to dust yet. My blood hadn't dried up. And I realized, even from that time, that sometimes just willpower is not enough. Just the effort, the trying, even the knowledge is not enough. There's something which is more important in those suttas. The contents was something much, much more powerful. The ability just to let go, to put things down, and allow your mind to become still, become peaceful. Now, I do this demonstration every year, and so it's usually the president has to help me on this one. So, Adrian, would you please come up? And you have to be honest and direct and even disrespectful. So in other words, don't just follow what I tell you, but I want you to actually just be absolutely honest here. The cup of water, my job now is to hold this water so it's perfectly still. So is it still yet, or is it moving?
Moving.
You know why? Because I'm not paying any attention. So now I'll be mindful. I'm now mindful of this water. Has it stopped moving yet?
Still moving.
It's moving. Okay, you know why? Because I'm not concentrating, not putting any effort in. So I'm aware, but I'm not putting effort. So I'm now going to put some effort in.
Still moving. The water is still moving.
Well, give me a chance, you know, just only started. I'm really trying.
Still moving.
Now, the reason I say this is because even yesterday somebody said over in Morfin Town Hall that they're meditating and they just can't do it. They've been struggling with their meditation. And if I hadn't got any wisdom, hadn't got a great teacher like an Ajahn Chah, I'd have been doing that as well, struggling, trying my hardest to hold this perfectly still, aware, putting forth effort, concentrating. You can try this for years, and I do this every year. Of BSV, but you know that sometimes you think, I just can't meditate, I can't do it, I can't hold even a cup of water still. How can I hold my mind still? And then you hear the great teachings of great masters, and actually nuns. Can we call them masters if they're highly enlightened? Or should we call them, because that's gender, that's male work, so we call them great mistresses.
Gender
neutral. We have to find a way. Because master is sort of okay, but mistress has many different meanings.
I don't think you need it.
Okay. And when I'm laughing, my cup's moving even more. So how can we manage to get this water to be perfectly still? You've seen this before. What should you do? Put it down and let go. It's such a simple teaching. Hang on, I haven't finished with you yet. Come back here, you disrespectful president. So now, Mr. President,
is it? Yes, the water is still.
Right. Now, you're honest?
Yes.
So you're not just saying this because
no.
I'm the spiritual advisor.
No.
Okay, very good.
Speaking the truth.
Okay, excellent. Very good. So that is actually just what the Buddha did. Yeah, okay. You're released. Trying all that hard to hold his mind still to find the truth. And learning just how to put it down and let it go. Now that letting go, is that Theravada? Is that Mahayana? Is that Vajrayana? Is that Christian? Is that Sufi? Is that Zen? Is that Tantra? Or is that, what the heck is that? It's just wisdom. So it's wonderful when we can actually learn to see something like this. Oh yeah, I get it. Because when you let things go, then the mind becomes still. When the mind becomes still, then all those thoughts, the discriminating thoughts which separate, that this is my Buddha, this is my Quran, this is my icons, all those thoughts tend to just stop, and you see what those thoughts are really trying to point towards. I will give you another little example before we open up for questions. Now I want you to not just listen to me, but listen to just the reaction. Love. 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 Okay, I finished there. Now, usually when you say a word, sometimes people can argue with you, so what's he on about? You know, I want to be taught, I know what love is. And then actually, after a while, you start to follow. What does actually love mean? Is it like the tennis match? Apparently the French Open is on right now. So is it just, you know, Mr. Djokovic is winning 6-love or something? No, not 6-love, it's 30-love or 40-love, whatever. But anyway, but then you actually stop all of that conversation, maybe think it's something else, you know, like the romantic love. But you keep on going. And after a while, you find that the word doesn't need to be repeated anymore. It points you in a direction. And eventually you can actually feel it. You can feel what that word is trying to describe. Let's try another one. Anger. 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 And after a while, you can actually feel, you know, what that word is trying to point towards. All of these words have meanings, but a lot of the times we don't go allow that word to linger long enough to really feel what that meaning is. And because of that, that's one of the reasons why we just never go deep enough to understand even things like what peace is. Peace. 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 Mushy peace. Peace. I like peace. But peace. After a while, you can actually feel it. Now that's the most important thing, but you can only feel these ideas, what they actually really mean, when your mind is still, when it stopped moving into thoughts. Similarly, is if ever you have the opportunity to go into wilderness areas, if ever you have the opportunity to go to a quiet place in the bush or in the mountains or even, well, it doesn't really work in deserts, this simile, and if you find like a lake high in the mountains, pristine lake, and if you're lucky enough to be there when there's no wind at all, then that lake will be so smooth, so undisturbed, so calm, that you will find a perfect reflection of the moon and the stars in the heavens above. But if there's even the slightest ripple, then you'll find the image is distorted. You can't see what the moon and the stars really look like. because of the ripple on the water. The same with the human mind. If there's even the slightest ripple, movement, disturbance, there's not enough stillness there. Of course, you'll never see an accurate description of the Dhamma. The reflection will be distorted. That is one of the reasons why, to be able to let go, to get that stillness and that truth, and find out that that is what all these books were written for. That's why Buddha is there. Look at that Buddha. You know, he hasn't moved since I started talking. Absolutely, isn't it? So that type of stillness, that is something which was really important to me when that first waysack, to say, yeah, it's not the thoughts, it's not the effort, it's learning just how to be still, how to be peaceful, how to actually to be able to allow the mind to be calm enough. It does act like a lake and reflects the truth around you accurately and perfectly, so that one doesn't need to go and argue with people. One doesn't need to say who is the best. It's one of the reasons why it's been quite easy over those years of trying to create those connections with the people from all the different parts of Buddhism. You know, to form, you know, what we call the Australian Sangha Association, the Federation of Australian Buddhist Councils, to actually to work together and to join in together and to actually have this wonderful sense of, you know, who's the best, who's the worst, whoever says they're the best are the worst, whoever says they're the worst, they're the best. I know that's a bit of a Christian teaching, whoever's first becomes last, but you know that is so true in life. And the people who sit at the front, you know, you find that you are the last to get to the toilets. Yeah, exactly, the last to leave. The wise people always sit in the back because you can get out first and get the tea. Unless you go the back way. But that. But even like the people, even the people who come last on the Bindabata line, the arms round line. Because, you know, you see what happens over, you put the rice in, and of course, you know, there's so much rice there, you have to tip it out, and tip it out. But the person who's very last, that's the rice we actually eat. So why does everyone want to be first? Being the last is the best. But anyway, so there we find out what the sort of the Dhamma really means is learning how to be peaceful, learning how to be still. And then you get innovation. You get insight, you see things. And it becomes great that you can start to understand things which people haven't seen before. And you know it's great because it leads to harmony, leads to peace, leads to growth, leads to freedom. Because sometimes people ask in this modern world, Ajahn Brahm, look, we live in a world where there's so much division and violence and lack of truth, lying, fake news. You know, people just trying to look after their own interests and just, you know, trying to sort of worry about their rights and not their responsibilities. And oh, just it can be a really complicated world. How on earth can we do something about that? You know, to make it a more peaceful world, understanding it will never be perfectly peaceful. If it was perfectly peaceful, then we wouldn't learn anything. So that's one of the reasons why, that if you have a peaceful mind, a still mind, it's amazing what you can see in others, what you can see in nature. It was wonderful if you can go and learn from nature. You know, one of the things which I remember seeing was staying in a hut in the north of Thailand 39 years ago, that it was the dry season. This was very close to the Burmese border. It was very remote and wilderness area up in the mountains. And up there, that because it was a dry season, I would leave a bowl of rice out. Leave a bowl of water out for the birds. And when I left a bowl of water out for the birds, They would not come if I was watching them. So I'd actually go inside my heart. There was a little knot hole, a little hole in the wooden boards of my heart. And I would, in the afternoon, peek out and just watch the birds drink the water. And what I never ever expected to see was the birds of so many different species, big ones, small ones, after a while form a queue. Every afternoon, about the same time, they would come to take some water and to, you know, to go inside the water bath, and they'd wash and get cooled down. And all these birds would actually form a line. And the first come, first in, and the one who came next would actually stand in line and wait. And it was so cute. But also, you'd see, there were always some birds who would try and jump the queue. And all the other birds would actually get out of queue, jump on that queue jumper, peck him or her, and chase them away. And then afterwards, they'd form the queue in exactly the same order they were before. And these were just wild birds in nature. They'd never been trained. They never needed a government. They never sort of schooled to do this. And it was so wonderful to see that just self-organization. It was so sort of cute to see that. They didn't have rules, they didn't have precepts, but they formed, you know, what for them was an obvious good thing to do. And I loved actually learning from nature. And just one of the other things which, one of the other wonderful things about learning from nature and how we can have peace and harmony is, you know, one of my favorite stories, which I use so often, of the trees in the forest. Whenever you go, I tell this to many people, they think, oh, it's really unfair, or this, they're really disadvantaged, or they're really depressed. To go out to a forest, or even to a seascape, to a rock face, and just to see just how imperfect, you know, the nature is. There's no such thing as a straight tree. Every tree is bent and crooked. Every tree has got damage to its bark. The mountains, the lakes, you always see this damage there. Natural damage over the years through erosion or through the storms. And it's that damage which makes the trees beautiful. When anyone does get depressed and think they're not good enough, think they're not perfect, I ask them to go into a forest or a wood and find the tree they like the best, the beautiful tree, the one they'd always like to go back to, the one they would like to take a photograph next to. I think that's why people want to take photographs with me, because I am imperfect. They take a photograph standing next to me, and when somebody comes up and said, oh, you know, Mr. Adrian, you're putting on weight. He said, well, look at my teacher. And you don't feel so bad. He's not so perfect. So anyway, actually we had the Australian Sangha Association conference, and there was a couple of senior monks. And I made sure they were in the front, and I made sure that I got my photograph taken sitting between them. I won't tell you who they are, but you know, it's one is a scholar of Pali, and he's only recently returned to Australia. The other one lives over in Canberra. But anyway, they're really big. And when I had my photograph taken with them, I said, Ajahn Brahma, you're not that fat. It's just relative truth, that's all. Depends who you sit next to. So I don't think I'd ever... You're not bad. I'm going to choose fat people to have my photograph taken. Not thin people. But no, anyway. So, but when we look at for a perfect tree, we find there's no such thing as a perfect tree. There's only beautiful trees. this actually changes some of the things which you're trying to do in life. Instead of trying to be beautiful, in the sense of your idea of perfection, we let things go. We see that that cup now is perfect. Instead of actually trying to straighten out all the trees in the forest, we realize the bent, crooked trees are the ones which were always the most beautiful. Instead of trying to straighten out your husband, you're bent and crooked, that's a beautiful one. Instead of trying to train your children to be what you think is perfect, you love your children. You find that's perfect. Instead of trying to improve your mind, this is one of the big bugbears, the self-improvement movement. There is no self, so what the heck are you trying to improve? Who said you're not good enough? You let go, put it down, stop trying to change things, and then you find it always was perfect, but you kept on disturbing it. This was the path of letting go, the path of learning how to be still. Always have to finish with a funny story about the person who went to the bookshop. He asked for, where's the self-help section? And the person on the counter said, if I told you where the self-help books were, it would defeat the purpose. So if ever people ask, ever going to write another book? If it was, it'd just be a book, Self-Improvement by Ajahn Brahm, and only one page, you're good enough. So be at peace. Let go. So thank you for listening. And it's now the time for the kids, unless anyone's got any objections or any quick questions or anything to ask. Okay. So okay, the tradition over here when I come to the BSV, at the end of a talk, we don't clap, we do the three sadhus. But not just ordinary sadhus, we give it everything we've got. Really big sadhus. So okay, you ready? You've done this before? One, two, three. Sadhu. Sadhu. Big one. Sadhu. It's giving a bit of effort, energy.